It's a joy to be with you. I hope if you ask questions that only the right side will ask them, because I've got an ear infection. The left side doesn't matter at all. I can't hear you at all. Last night, I shared a lesson with the church that I serve and got in the car and drove up. I told them, well, what a joy. Get to be with the family, today, here in Montgomery, and tomorrow I'm with the family in Tennessee. And that's the church. And that's the great thing that it is. And what a joy. And then it dawned on me as I came into breakfast, oh no, a group of preachers. The terror overcame me. I'm teasing. I just wrote a little blog for the Jeff Jenkins and Dale Jenkins about my journey to preaching. And when I was 19, as a son of a missionary and son of a preacher, people would ask, what are you going to be when you grow up? You know, I'd say, I'm not going to do that. I can't fill those shoes. No way. I don't know that stuff. No way. And now, a bunch of years later, 10 grandchildren later, I can't think of anything nobler or wiser or more needed than preaching. So I changed my mind. So God bless you and thank you for this occasion. I didn't bring books to impress anybody. We bring books to say we have more to learn. We have more to do until God calls us home. His Word is the only book that I'm going to grab if there's a fire. The works of men are there to hopefully illustrate, help. I don't know why I'm here. I know why the other gentlemen are here. All of you have probably preached through Romans. I think I'm here because I grew up a son of a missionary. I grew up 160 miles from Rome. I go there every year, the semester of abroad. I take groups, students, people. I retrace the footsteps of the Apostle Paul. I go every year to Corinth, to Ephesus, to Jerusalem. I go in semesters abroad. It's been my privilege since the age of 19 to be able to do that. So I trace in the footsteps of the Apostle Paul. So if your question is, do you love the Apostle Paul? The answer is, absolutely. I fell in love with him when I was 19, and I've been in love with him ever since. I'm not a perfect man, but a man that God used for great things. And if he's not an example of something, then we missed the boat. We don't understand the man. When I asked one of my colleagues at Falk University in the School of Theology about Romans, about 10 of them, I went, whoa, Romans. Two of them got real excited. Dr. Cecil May, you may know, he writes for the Gospel Advocate, and he's preached through it many times, so he's achieved a comfort level with Romans, the theological treaties. There are others of us that kind of say, whoa, give me Ephesians, give me Colossians, give me heresy, give me Era of the Church, give me Philippians, a thank you letter, give me those. But save Romans for last. And it's definitely the challenge, how do you preach Romans to the teenagers? Well, you know what grabs teenagers and college people? That's who I teach. Getting them back to the original audience. And that's what you gave me. So here is my best shot in the next 30 minutes. How to make them want to read Romans and want to extract from it all the depth and the riches that can be extracted. And fall in love with the Apostle Paul in the process. And understand the original audience. In the Restoration Movement, Thomas Campbell and Angelica Campbell, they spoke of context, which is my assignment today. Context matters. It's what I have to do personally before I drop into a letter. I can't just drop into a letter. You quote me a verse and I'm supposed to be there already. We do that sometimes in our preaching, and we need to ease people in, it seems to me. You can't give the whole context. Whole context is what a study Bible, like, you know, the ESV. It's 2,800 pages because it's got a lot of context and footnotes at the bottom. Only the text is inspired, but the footnotes do help you ease into the 20th century old letter by a man named Paul from a city called Tarsus that he wrote to a congregation probably in the year 57. This is what I understand correct hermeneutics to be. Interpretation of Scripture. One, you need to determine what a passage meant to those who first received it. That's what I think you must do with Romans. And then, of course, step number two, very important, don't stop. Step number one is to make it applicable to those that you're preaching to and teaching to today. So, this is what Alexander Campbell had to say. He said, when you preach, You determine word meanings, interpret figures, using context, determining dispensation, old or new, understanding the conditions which prevailed when the book was written, noting who speaks and to whom, coming within understanding distance of things written long ago. I love that last phrase, coming to an understanding distance. The next 30 minutes are about that. I'm sure you've already been there if you've been in Romans and been in the Word all your life, but I guess this is a reminder of what can be done. These are all a list of things that are the context. I don't have time to do all of them, so I'm going to emphasize mainly the first one, history and archaeology and culture of the Greco-Roman world of Rome in the year 57 AD. I'm probably not going to finish in the question and answer period. I will not answer any questions about theology. I will defer that to my colleagues, Dr. McClarty and Dr. Robertson. But maybe I can answer something about context. That's what at least I deal with more. Here is the basics that you already know. The book of Romans, by all accounts, was written at the end of what we call Paul's third missionary journey. When we get to heaven, he's going to tell us and clarify it was not his third missionary journey. He had been a missionary journey since he was converted in Damascus and went to Arabia, and then it's about his 942nd missionary journey, not the third, but it's what we call that. And the years that were assigned to that is about 52 to 57 A.D. This letter was written towards the end of that, the longest of the recorded missionary journeys of the Apostle Paul. There are less 10 years about in Cilicia that we don't even have a record of, I'll remind you of. We have a lot more about Paul than any other apostle, but we don't have everything about him here. It's probably written from Corinth. There's Corinth right there. We are on the eastern side of the Roman world. Romans now, 29 legions are patrolling all the Mediterranean world. The only parts that they still haven't achieved by the year 57 AD is parts of what we call Great Britain and parts of what we call Germany. Some barbarian tribes there are still resisting Roman legions. They're going to fall too over the next 50 years. The last time Roman legions conquer is under the Emperor Trajan in the early 2nd century. And then after that, it's hold the fort time, and they're not going to be able to do that. You see, it's too big. But it is impressive in the year 57. Rome is like there to stay forever, as far as anybody can understand. Unless God steps into the story, like he did with the story of Sennacherib back in 701, the Romans are going to be around forever. They thought so, and so did everybody else. They're the most organized, bureaucratic, military-based. Their military machine is massive. And they don't know this. They came here in the middle of the 2nd century before Christ. They conquered Greece in the 2nd century before Christ. They came down to Jerusalem in 63 before Christ. It took 3 months of a siege and about 12,000 dead Jews. God did not step in to help them out. And the whole point of Roman is this. Why waste your lives? We're here to stay. And unless your God is better than our gods, you don't have a chance. Not with what we got. This is the context. The Romans have been around now in Palestine for the last 100, well, you do the math, 60 plus 57, about 110, 120 years. That's four generations. And it's going to be many, many more as far as anybody can understand. Paul is writing from Corinth. This is the third largest city in the empire right here. If Rome is the first, that's where we got to go. Alexandria of Egypt is number two with about 1 million people. And Corinth is, by the accounts of Strabo, a geographer, about 700,000. That's about half of them slaves and half of them free people, which is a reminder to you of the context in which the Christianity was spread. No wonder Paul speaks in Ephesians and Colossians about getting right the relationships in the church, husbands and wives, parents and children. What's number three? Masters and slaves. You walked on the streets of Corinth where Paul is probably writing the letter. One out of two people on every sidewalk was a slave. And so in the church in Corinth, you've got a mixture and having to sit on the same pew. How do you put together people that own slaves to people that are slaves? The Roman tax system was based upon how many slaves you had. 3, here's your taxes. 10, here's your taxes. 15, here's your taxes. Up to 100, 500. 500 is a company. A company of slaves. That's the reality. More people were enslaved in the history of the world in the time that Paul's writing was letter than ever in the history of mankind. Now you and I are privileged to live in a time when there's no slavery. Isn't that neat? But the Roman Empire was the absolute opposite. More people were enslaved. No wonder he has to say to slaves, be a Christian and a good slave. And to masters, you can't be a master like you were under Roman law. You got to be different if you're in the church. This is the context. I want to stress looking west. In the year 57, it is the 23rd year, as best I can tell, of the ministry of Apostle Paul. Converted in about the year 34, personal appearance of the resurrected Lord on the road to Damascus. He is 23 years into his ministry. I am sure he thought he was going to die many times before. When he writes the letters of Corinthians, he says, makes a list of things that have happened to him, shipwrecks, beatings, etc. And yes, the Romans were not like the Jews. They would do beatings and just to an inch of death, but you know, getting close to death is getting to death sometimes. And yes, they had no problem with capital punishment, and their method, they had no police. The only way of ascertaining information was to torture people and beat them. There was no Miranda rights. There was no police. There was an army, and they had a methodology, and it was pretty brutal. Paul probably thought he was going to die many times before. He's left for dead in Lystra, remember? As he is stoned, right? And everybody else thought he was dead, too. So, in 57... how old is he? Probably born in the first decade after Christ. He's probably a man in his 50s. Average age for a Palestinian man to live was 44 at the time. So he's about 10 years past that. And with all that has happened to him, all the scars and stripes that he has on him. And yet he's looking to, what am I going to do next? He has taken off out of here. He evangelized there for about 8 years. He was in Jerusalem. Then he established churches in the first missionary journey in Derbe, Lystra, Iconium, Antioch of Pisidia. And then he got to go on the second missionary journey across there at Troas. He caught the boat and went to Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea, down to Athens and Corinth. And he's evangelized the eastern part of the world. But he's looking west. He's looking west. He's looking west. Look at Romans 15, chapter 15, verse 19 says, so that from Jerusalem and round about as far as Illyricum I have fully preached the gospel of Christ. For this reason I have often been prevented from coming to you, he says, but now with no future place in these regions, and since I have had for many years a longing to come to you whenever I go to Spain, for I hope to see you in passing. Several things I extract from these two verses is, one, he had never been there, and yet he's a Roman citizen. Wow. He has a Roman passport. He's an Orthodox Jew trained to be in the Supreme Council of the Pharisees and of the Sanhedrin. And he has a Roman passport, which only 5% of the world possess at that time. And he's never been to Rome. He has been in his travels to at least, we know in the New Testament records, 6 colonies. And a colony is like a mini Rome. And Antioch of Pisidia was one. But how about Philippi? Now, the second missionary journey, when he walked into that one, wow. That one all had Roman names on the doorbells. I'm teasing, they had no doorbells, but still. In the ruins of Philippi today, we have about 110 different monuments and inscriptions, and they're all in Latin. But you're in northern Greece, you're in Macedonia. What is Latin doing in northern Greece? Well, Roman Emperor Octavian Augustus had just told all the Greeks to leave, and settled veterans of his army after an important battle that had been fought right there in northern Greece. So there were little mini Romes everywhere. He had been to those. He'd been to Philippi, but never been to Rome. But I want to come there. He wants to take his ministry west. This is a shift, I believe. He's writing in 57, I can't believe I've gotten everything done by the help of God, by the grace of God, in the eastern part of the Mediterranean world. Now I'd like to go west. Rome would be number one, and from Rome then will be the catapulting point to Spain, to the west. And if you look at the map of Rome at that time, so he came from here, and his hometown was here, came to Jerusalem about the age of 15 to train, and then met the resurrected Lord right there, and then that changed his life for the rest of his life. And he took the gospel to the region of Asia, and then he crossed over and went into Greece and Macedonia and Achaia. And what he's writing the Romans from here is, I want to come here so I can make this, I think, my base to go west. To go west. A shift kind of in his ministry. The Roman letter, the letter to the Romans, is Paul's longest letter. The early church, when they organized Paul's letters, collected them in the 2nd century. Put them in order not of chronology, but in order of size. which is kind of logical in one way. You've got from Romans all the way to Philemon. Standard Greco-Roman letters were about one chapter, as you might call them. But remember, they didn't write in chapters and verses. The cheaper way of writing was on vellum, but papyrus from Egypt had begun to be more available. And so it's possible that the scribes that Paul hired in his time were using papyrus paper. Either way, they were using mostly the scroll system rather than the book system. The book system will come in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th century. They were using scrolls still, papyrus scrolls or animal skin scrolls. It's the longest. We know who the scribe was in this case. That's a rare case. We know the name of the scribe. His name is Tertius, and he is in the last part, and in one of the many names in the last part of the book of Romans. That's his name right there. It's 1622. The book of Romans looks very much like a dictation because it has 144 times the Greek word gai, which is translated, of course, for. That's a typical way for a scribe when they're taking down notes from someone to write things down. So Tertius is the scribe, but he is not interjecting any words. Timothy is a co-sender with 6 of Paul's letters, but is not a co-writer. There's a difference. Tertius is just the scribe. His way of doing bullet points is to put gar, for, in the text. Some say this is his best systematic treatment of the Christian faith. And the word treatise, it appears probably in your study Bibles or whatever, maybe you view it that way too. And that's, of course, true. That's one of the reasons it's so scary. It's a treatise. It's a theological treatise. You have to be in graduate school to enjoy that stuff, right? Dr. Cecil May told me, I don't think it's a treatise. I think it's a sermon. It's a sermon. That's what I think it is. Of course, I like that better than treatise. Because treatise is what scared me about Romans. A sermon. It's a deep sermon. It's not a pizza pan sermon. Because, you know, we tragically have done those from time to time, right? As shallow as a pizza pan. We knew it when we finished. We said, I'm not going to do that again. I'm gonna go deep. If you're going to go deep, well, a sermon deep would be Romans. This is not a treatise. It's a sermon because he's aware of the critical issues that need to be addressed. He's looking at his audience from Corinth. He's looking 100 miles away without the modern-day methods of FaceTime and cell phones. He gets his information about the Roman congregation from somewhere, somehow, somebody. He is informed. He knows that. He knows the Roman church. He's not playing guesswork. That's clear there. Now, here in the last part, probably one of the things I've discovered this lately, and you may disagree with me, that's okay, but some say Paul already views with ominous undertones his return to Judea. When did he start receiving those visions in which he is told when you get to Jerusalem at the end of the third missionary journey, you're going to get to trouble, you know? He's going to get others begging him not to go at the end, too. When did he start getting those? I don't know the timing exactly, but does he somehow know that there's going to be trouble? You see, he's going to get arrested in 57, as recorded in Acts. He's going to spend 2 years in Caesarea by the sea. Then he's going to have a very eventful journey narrated in those gorgeous 2 chapters at the end of the book of Acts, right? Chapter 27 and 28. The most outstanding train wreck ever happened, except it's a boat wreck, right? Wow. It's like a slow motion. Beautiful writing of Luke. Inspired and good. Both that and then he's going to spend at least 2 years waiting for his trial in Rome. That we know. Is Romans written right before that, and does he know anything? That's question number one. Question number two. Is he trying to make the Roman church to whom he's writing this very deep sermon, is he trying to make them the next starting point for his mission efforts? Antioch of Syria has been his home base since Barnabas retrieved him in the year 46. It is now the year 57. It's 11 years later. And he says, as you just read in chapter 15, that he has he's looking to come west, Spain, to move his ministry west. So, does he want the Roman church to be his supporting congregation, his starting point, to go west, to go to Spain? Is that the case? At least that's what a possibility is. Okay. We have no evidence that he had ever been to Rome. But he had been to other colonies of Rome, and he had talked with hundreds of people that came and went from Rome. You see, the first century AD was the most mobile civilization ever in the history of mankind, because Rome owned all Mediterranean. Ships of Rome, its navy, crisscrossed. You could, for the first time, go from east to west. It took about 4 to 6 weeks to travel, let's say, from Palestine to Spain, depending on the time of the year. You can't travel by seas all the time. There's 3 or 4 months a year when you have to stay put. But Rome had made possible for the most mobile civilization ever in the history of mankind. And so there are people coming and going, and so he's getting this information, even though he's not been there. He's had, in the last 23 years, a lot of information from members of the way of Jesus of Nazareth that have traveled back and forth. Couriers, a lot of Christian couriers, that's what I'm talking about, that brought news. The letter of Romans is seemingly going to be delivered not by UPS or by mail, but by a person. Kind of like Tychicus is the guy who puts the letters of Ephesians, Colossians, and Philemon all in one satchel and heads off towards from Rome. Prison epistles heads towards the east, about 1,000-mile journey by donkey, foot, and boat, all of the above. Phoebe, she is complimented by Paul at the end of Romans. She is from one of evidently several congregations that have been established in the Corinth area. Cenchrea is the name of the little port town on which he sails at the end of the third missionary journey to go home. And Phoebe, he compliments, and she's evidently a businesswoman. What is she? Kind of like Lydia. Why is she going to Rome? Well, business takes you to Rome. It's the largest, it's the epicenter of, it's like a, you know, there's a gigantic wheel in the center of it all is the capital of Rome and power of money. Everything is there. And I don't know why Phoebe's going, but one of the reasons she's going is to deliver the letter, I think, of Romans. That's one of the reasons. The point is, Paul knew about the Roman church, and the Roman church was known to others. And so I believe that it had a rich history. This is Rome, in a quick map of the time. Of course, you recognize today what's one of the most visible things. The Colosseum is actually not going to be finished until 79, so about 20 years after the Book of Romans is written. It's a major entertainment center of Rome. This one is already there and has been there for a while. It's called the Circus Maximus, Rome. If you had never visited Rome and visited there for the first time, you would have been both impressed, awed, and scared to death. Largest city in the world. Never had been one that big, 2 million people. Some were conservative and say a million, though. I'm going to go with a larger number. There was a big difference between the have and the have-nots, between the rich and the poor. There were the senatorial, the equestrian families of the Romans that were extremely wealthy, extreme wealth. Roman legions conquered and then brought back stuff. And there were over 300 triumphal processions of downtown Rome during its height of power. That means every time that one of the Roman generals conquers somewhere, somebody, they bring slaves back, which are distributed. The numbers that we have of slaves that are brought back are staggering. 30,000, 100,000, 50,000. And this is how you know where they got all the slaves that will operate. It will be like a piston in the economy of Rome. If you took out that piston, the motor will work. They had to have 100,000 new slaves every year to make the Wall Street go. They had to replace. When they don't get them by war, they're going to have them by birth. Have slaves have children that are going to replace slaves. That's not going to play out well in the centuries to come. But this is Rome. It's had its own law since the 5th century before Christ, the 12 tables are called. They are a bureaucratic organization that you wouldn't believe. They are impressive in their engineering, in their structure, in their establishment of power. They came out of nowhere. They were nothing in 753 before Christ, a mythological date of Rome. Romulus and Remus, a cute story about two infants that were supposedly suckled by a she-wolf. And that's the symbol of Rome that's stamped all over the Mediterranean still today. You will find the she-wolf as a symbol of Rome in North Africa. That's where Rome went, and it's in expansion in that time. But that's a cute story. What's real is this. This is real. Can you imagine Epaphroditus? You remember him? Coming to look for Paul to give him the money from the Philippians. He didn't have a Google map. He didn't have a cell phone. And this is the Tiber River right here. This was the Jewish ghetto right here. I imagine Epaphroditus looking for Paul, going in the Jewish ghetto, let's start there, going up, asking down the street, have you all heard of a guy named Paul of Tarsus? And somebody finds out, I think he's up on that building over there, 8th floor up at the top. And, you know, do you understand how the God intervention, Epaphroditus finding Rome, finding Paul in a city of Rome with 2 million people? Wow, what an event. Well, there it is. Entertainment, power, money, politics, all of that. In the midst, there was probably not one, but several meetings of people of the way. I guess there was more than one. That would be my guess. They didn't have buildings. There won't be any church buildings until Constantine legalizes Christianity and they start building basilicas. They meet in homes, of course. We know that. But there are some homes in this massive world right here. This is a model of Rome of the time. This is the Tiber River. There's the Colosseum. Again, it was not finished yet. But Circus Maximus, that was the largest entertainment center in the history of the world. 250,000 people. 250,000 people could fit in it. The largest stadium that I know of is not football in America, but actually soccer in Brazil. It's about 130,000. We don't even achieve the levels of engineering that. Staggering. You need to think about it in terms of you come to preach a crucified Messiah in this context, and they say, your leader's a crucified Messiah? What things that demonstrate your power you have? Well, we don't have buildings. We don't have buildings. We don't have anything like that. Here is the Circus Maximus. Chariot races were held here. Of course, in here, the gladiator fights. One of the things that if you're a Gentile and you convert to Christianity, you're going to have to abandon is that and that, because the first 15 minutes in either of those is made with offerings to the pagan gods. And then there's the brutality. You know, front row seats is the best because, in the Colosseum, because you get actually the splatter of human blood or human sinew or human saliva as the fight. That, those were the preferred seats. Even the Gentile Romans, the pagan Romans said, what have we come to? The point is, human beings, in the name of entertainment, can do pretty atrocious things. Circus Maximus was operating, and it was a grand thing, but once again, I wonder if you can go there anymore. If you were converted away as a Gentile from the pagan faith. This is what left the Circus Maximus today. The great centers of power of man always end up in dust. Ramses II thought he was hot stuff in the 14th century before Christ, the Egyptian pharaoh, but his statues are all in the sand of Egypt, and he is dead. So are the emperors that had their houses right up here. This is the imprint of the Circus Maximus, what's left in Rome of it at that time. This is the Roman Forum. This is there were several forums, but the big one was where all the temples of the gods were. And that is part of my assignment as well. I'm looking at my time and to see how far I can get here. This is what's left. This is the model, what was. This is what's left today. There is the Roman, there's a forum of Caesar, there's a forum of Augustus, this is the main Roman forum. Forum is the Latin word for a marketplace, the Greek agora. And this is where you could buy an apple, you could buy legal advice, and you would definitely go to make your public offerings to the gods. And there they were, typical Roman temple, with one entrance. You couldn't come from all four sides. That's a Greek temple. And they were on a higher pedestal. And Rome had its own gods before it conquered the Greeks. And then when it conquered the Greeks, it said, wow, you guys have a sophisticated mythology system of gods. I think I like yours. So they basically merged them. So we call them Greco-Roman by the time Paul is preaching. He's dealing with the Greco-Roman gods. This is a model of the Colosseum. This is a model of a theater. Greeks had started theatrical works as a favorite way to present ideas. It wasn't just about entertainment, it was about instruction too. The Romans had taken the Greek theater and doubled it, and that's called amphitheater or double theater. Both of these are in Rome, and this is what you should be impressed with by the Romans and their engineering skills. It's called the arch, the Roman arch. With the Roman arch, without reinforced steel, they did have cement. They built incredible things. They are impressive. They are impressive as a people. Rome. One of the things that the Roman legions will do when they don't fight is build roads. And all roads lead to, and they still do. You can find decent Roman roads in Libya, North Africa, Spain. You can find them in Philippi, the Ignatian Way, Ignatian Road. And Paul started that Macedonian missionary trip, the second missionary journey. He got off at the port of Neapolis. We have no record of him evangelizing that. Paul's methodology was to hit the major big centers, because from there then the gospel will go. Kind of like when you squish a pregnant spider, right? It'll go places. So he evangelizes Philippi. He does not evangelize Amphipolis and Apollonia. He just goes through them. But he stops at Thessalonica, which is a major center. Then he runs to Berea, 20 miles down the road. All three of those centers are on a major Roman road called the Ignatian Road. I don't have a map of that, but I can show you all the major ones that lead to Rome. If you come, like Epaphroditus did, and you want to go to Rome, and probably you come to right here, you catch a boat across, and you get on the Appian Way, the blue one that brings you all the way in. The Apostle Paul will come in the year spring of the year 60, into right here, into that bay right there. And then he will connect right nearby with the Appian Way. That is not recorded in the book of Acts, but it's the only major road of Rome that leads into that city. He will come in as a prisoner. What's recorded beautifully in Acts chapter 28, verse 15, is that encounter of people of the way of the Roman church within. Please connect that. Acts 28, verse 15. Members of the church in Rome, near 60, 3 years after he wrote this letter, loved him enough to get an entourage of people that took off work and came 50 miles south here to the three taverns in Forum of Appius, and to come meet him, to encourage him, to meet him in person 3 years after he writes the letter of Romans. Wow. That's what Christians do. They take care of each other. They love each other. Had the letter of Romans endeared him to them, or did they already love him before? I don't know, but I don't know how many of them, 20, 30, 40, 50, came down to meet him 3 years later, right there at the Forum of Three Taverns and Forum of Appius on the Appian Way. Well, in the world of politics, they didn't get to elect their presidents. They elected themselves. Rome had been founded as a republic in the year 509 before Christ, but by the year 31 before Christ, a guy called Octavian had settled the issue of who was going to rule Rome. Rome is no longer a republic. It has shifted political systems. It is an empire. One man rules Rome. The Senate is still there, but that's just for show. They still have houses of money. You still have to have a ton of a bank account to be an equestrian or a senator. You have to show that you own slaves and money, but they handle small potato stuff in downtown. The emperor really controls everything. Here are emperors that relate to us in the letter of Romans. First emperor, Octavian Augustus. He rules over 40 years, and he dies, and he passes the scepter on to his son, Tiberius. God sent his son in the fullness of time, Galatians 4, verse 4. And I understand that to mean that God looked down at the human history and said, this is the right time. When God sent his son, it was during the reign of the first emperor of Rome. There was one man ruling the world. And then his son, Tiberius, was the time when the Son of God went to the cross and died. And Pilate was a governor under Tiberius. There had been Caligula, and he was bad, bad. That already tells you, emperors and empire are look good on the outside, the rich and the powerful and the organized, but the corruption on the inside, what we might call the White House of the time, the Imperial Palace, is tremendous. The corruption level is. Claudius actually comes to power because Caligula is assassinated by the Roman army. And he is not bad. He's a fairly good administrator. But what you and I know about him that relates to the book of Romans is this down here. He is famous. One of the Roman historians by the name of Suetonius says in one of his works that he emanated an edict that kicked out Jews out of Rome at the instigation of, and here in the Latin is the word Christos, C-H-R-E-S-T-O-S, which is an interesting misspelling of Christos, which is the Greek for Messiah, Christos. So what was happening in Rome in 49 that made the emperor kick out Jews? There were a lot of Jews in Rome. I'll need to go ahead and put that on some other slide and we'll get to it. There were a lot. When they conquered Jerusalem in 63 before Christ, the Romans had brought back a ton of Jewish slaves. You resist Rome? We take your brightest and best and come park them as slaves in Rome. You're going to pay for resisting Rome. There is a strong Jewish ghetto community in Rome. There has been for a while, for a good 110 years. But here is interesting. Jews and Jewish Christians are expelled from Rome. Not all of them. And it is a temporary thing. It happens in 49, but by 57, probably most have returned. Actually, you know somebody that left and returned. They're called Aquila and Priscilla. Where does Paul meet that wonderful... They get the award for the most traveled couple in the New Testament that I know of. They're from the Black Sea originally. If I pull that back up, these people get around a whole lot more than we do without, you know, all the planes and cars and stuff. They're from the Black Sea. They're business people, they're tent makers. And he meets them in Corinth, but they've been expelled from Rome. They will go to Ephesus, but then they're going to go back to Rome, which is what I was trying to say. That is that the expulsion of the Jews from Rome is a temporary thing. It doesn't last forever. But it does affect some of the Jewish Christians. And here's a very important thing. Does it affect, I would suggest this to you, the leadership of the community of the faith of the way that's in Rome? And I think that's the point. The Roman congregations were 100% Jewish at the beginning, is my understanding. At some point, a few years or decades in, they started acquiring Gentiles too. And by the year 49, a lot of the leadership, Jewish leadership of the Roman congregation was expelled. And so Gentiles became the prevalent number rather than the minority. That is my understanding of context. That helps me to understand Romans better. Paul's talking about the weaker and the stronger. And he's talking about a lot of Jewish things because there is a strong Jewish root or component to the Roman family. But there's also a strong Gentile presence, because otherwise, how do you understand that list of vices in Romans chapter 1? Wow, that's impressive. Well, just a quick look back. That is the emperor that will take over in 54. Claudius will be assassinated with a poison mushroom. His third wife, Agrippina, will give it to him for dinner. He will die assassinated at the court. Dinner table is a very dangerous place at the imperial court. I recommend highly you skip it. If you get an invitation, don't go. Nero has absolutely no experience, none. Nobody likes him, and he fancies himself to be a musician. He is mediocre, and he would not even make the trials of American Idol. But because he's emperor, he puts on shows and invites people, and you've got to go. Tacitus, in his Annals of Imperial Rome, says it was a nightmare to get invited to one of his concerts. This is the guy that will put Paul on trial. You do remember that, right? We're expecting justice out of him. He gave his mother a booby-trapped yacht, and she started bugging him. And when the booby-trapped yacht didn't work, then he just sent his Navy lieutenants to kill her. 59. That's 2 years after the Book of Romans. He will assassinate his own stepbrother, Britannicus, at the dinner table and joke about him being epileptic. And this is the guy that's going to administer justice to the Apostle Paul? That would be true. You don't want to know the rest of the stuff that Claudius Aquinas Barbus, that was his name, he comes down to us known as Nero, what he did. Now, the church, that mass more. I don't have much time left, so here is a quick rundown of some things. It is Gentile, but also anchored. Jeremy, where are you at? Jeremy Barrier, yeah. Where's Andrew? I'm sorry. Should I go 5 more minutes? 10 or whatever? Jump, okay? Hi, Jeremy. Good to see you. Roman Church, you're the next speaker. So I got to ask the next speaker, right?
is Gentile, but it's also anchored in a Jewish community. What does Gentile mean?
I'll be glad to give you any of these things. You can find out. These are textbooks on Roman culture of the time. What does it mean to be a Gentile? I think it's helpful to describe to a modern-day faithful people the context. A lot of these Roman believers were coming out. Sir Edward Gibbon, a source from a 17th century historian, he says about religion in Rome and the Greco-Roman world, the various modes of worship which prevailed in the Roman world were all considered by the people as equally true, by philosophers equally false, and by the magistrates as equally useful. So let's get this. Politicians thought that religion was a good thing. Philosophers were very skeptical of religion, while the people in general were practicing it, whether they were sincere or not. But pithion is the main word in Greco-Roman religion. Most of those who came in, they were in the leadership of the Roman church at this time, they understood that you were trying to buy off the gods with your offerings and your attendance at the temples. They had absolutely none of these. Gods did not provide, there's no grace in the Greco-Roman gods. No concept of love, no concept of justice. And morality? I don't think so. Have you read the mythologies associated with the head god called Zeus? He's the greatest philanderer of them all. But is he going to teach us about sex? I don't think so. No. He fathers more children with mortal women than his wife can stomach. Her name is Hera. And that's part of the story. They don't have a separation of church and state. We do that now, and that's good. But they didn't have that. The emperors used religion for their political purposes. Some might contend that presidents still do that, but that's not the point. Theoretically, we have separation of church and state. They did not at all. In the ancient world, that was not present. Okay? They were very tolerant. They said religion is welcome. But if you're a polytheist, that means we got 250 gods. If we had 25 more, it's okay. The ones to whom that was not okay was the only ones in the world that were monotheistic, which is, of course, those strange, weird, quirky Jews. One? Really? One? What's your problem? Why can't you add, we can't. Our God said one. Okay. Now, Romans practiced their religion in private and in public, which is an interesting thing to us today. Our government seems to be wanting us to push our religion into the privacy of our heads and in our church buildings. And here's the fact. You can't do that to Christianity. Romans didn't think you could do it to any religion. Religion is to be practiced in a private, say, of your home, and in the public arena. It's supposed to be done in both of those. Worship was state worship. Worship of state gods. The politics was about religion as well. They had many options. They could do ancestor worship in their homes. They had house gods. They had mystery cults. The letter of Ephesians, Colossians are replete with the word mystery, intentionally because mystery cults were a fad. Now, Paul uses mystery in a different way. Using the word mystery, in my opinion, is because mystery cults were very faddish at that time. They had a new thing on the scene of Roman history called emperor worship. The first emperor had started that. We deified Caesar, Julius Caesar. Philosophy schools represented kind of a... they weren't just an academic degree. They were actually a how-can-you-explain-life-and-give-meaning-to-life type thing. And so they qualify as a religious option as well. And then, of course, there were the Olympian gods, and I don't have time to walk through those. But boy, downtown Rome, did you have a bunch of them. This is the best-preserved Roman monument in Rome today, a reminder to you of the significant presence of buildings. This is the Pantheon, the temple to all the gods. And it's not only a marble engineering, it is a representation of the status and presence of the Greco-Roman gods in the Greco-Roman world of Rome. So the Roman believers that came out of this were meeting in houses and had left this. Now, this particular structure was finished in the early 2nd century, but this is a concept, an idea, you could say. These gods, all the gods, Zeus, Hera, Poseidon, Hades, Athena, Apollo, the only word that really matters right there to understand the Greco-Roman gods is anthropomorphic, which means the Greeks and the Romans had fashioned their gods in the form of men. They were exaggerated forms of it, and they were exaggerated forms in the sense of the best and the worst vices and virtues of men were represented in the gods. So if men are philanderers, then Zeus is a super philanderer. If Hera is, if a wife is jealous of a husband that cheats, then Hera, the wife of Zeus, is super jealous, and she can only take it out, however, on the mortal women that he has affairs with. That's a surreal. What? You worship those kind of gods? You want to say, really? Really? But they had big houses. They had big houses. These are the other gods. Look, walk inside the pantheon. You go, whoa. Man, you built a big house to non-existent gods that have crazy stories. Wow. For real? Yeah. Men, intelligent, smart people will do that. Now, if you're a preacher, if you're Paul, you got to talk people out of this. And let's see, in Ephesus, they spent nearly 3 years in the worship of the most worshipped deity of that pantheon. Her name was Artemis. It was not Zeus, by the way. It was Artemis, who was the most worshipped. Why did he spend 3 years in Ephesus? Because he was on the battlefront of man-made gods. God, talk them out of this. Nice buildings, but nobody's there. The lights are on, but nobody's home. And it's the greatest tragedy you've ever seen. The one true living God, right? Speech from Marcel. That's what I want to take you to. These are ruins and realm of the temples to Hercules, Vesta. She's like the hearth gods to the Saturn, Castor and Pollux. One of the ships that Paul will sail on is from the island of Malta to will have the figures of Castor and Pollux on the front. That's in Acts chapter 28. You'll find that. Romans chapter 1, verse 22, he says, although they claim to be wise, boy, they're present in so many ways, they became fools and exchanged the glory of mortal God of it for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. That's a reminder to you, the Egyptian gods with the head of human beings, and the head of animals, crocodile, various birds in the body of men. He's referring to the Greco-Roman gods and the Egyptian gods and man-made gods in general. Morality? I don't think so. The God said nothing about sex. This is one of the brothels of Pompeii, one of the best preserved Roman cities, just south of Rome. It was a get away from the hustle and bustle of Rome city down south. It was submerged by the volcano. Vesuvius exploded in 79. This is an advertisement. It's on a sidewalk in Ephesus for a brothel. This is a woman right here, and this is a foot. Say, go up to the left, and there's a brothel. Women you usually marry at the age of 14. The only reason was because of the thought that if you had too much sex, then you would not be able to bear children. And the function of a wife was like buying a truck. You buy a wife to get progeny. And so to make sure you get progeny from the wife, you marry young. But brothels were everywhere. And that's the reality of the Greco-Roman world. So that's the background. A lot of the Roman believers. So now maybe if we understand better the Romans 1 list of vices. He wasn't exaggerating. Even the Romans will tell you, man, those Jews, they got more rules than you spit at, 613. Their gods gave them so many rules. They will say, our rules didn't come from our gods. We made them up. And the gods have nothing to teach us about morality and sexuality. No, we're having to figure that out on our own. That's the way they view it. One last thing. Roman community of believers was Greco-Roman for most of their background, coming from that background. They're also Jews. This is a synagogue in Ostia, which is just outside of Rome, one of the rare ones that we found. The community of Jews was strong. In the Greco-Roman world, the estimate is among 70 to 80 million people that inhabited the Mediterranean, about 6 to 7 million were Jewish. That's staggering. Some say 8% of the population of the Greco-Roman world was Jewish. Wow. It had to do with their children, their inclusivity. In Rome, we know there were 12 synagogues of the Jews. 12. Not one. A bunch. In the largest city. Obviously, the first Jews that arrived in 63 before Christ, but the first Christians, I believe, arrived in the aftermath of the Sermon of the Day of Pentecost, Acts chapter 2, verse 10. Among the geography lesson that Luke gives you of how many Jews were coming from different parts of the empire for that second most important holiday of the Jews in their calendar, there was Jews from Rome.
And when that event was over, some of the converted Jews in Rome, I think, went back and founded the congregation. So it's been in existence, in my understanding, for about 27 years. Here's a map real quick of Jewish presences. Of course, Jerusalem being a big one here, a lot of the, of course, the area of Palestine.
But there are more Jews living outside of Palestine at the time of Paul than in. More Jews outside because of the dispersion. This is the map of the dispersion. Alexandria of Egypt had about 70,000 or more. And then other major centers. Why does Paul, who's apostle to the Gentiles, go to a lot of places that have Jewish synagogues? Because that's his methodology, right? I'm going to go to the Gentiles by going to the synagogues. He goes into the synagogues, and on the back pews, so to speak, they didn't have pews, he finds the Gentiles that are already interested in one God. And from that point, he can get into the Gentile community. I'm not going to have time to do that, but here is the result of it all. The Roman Church, in my opinion, is mostly Gentile at this point. It's the effect of the expulsion of 49. But it is anchored in a group of Jews that was all Jewish from the beginning. And they're struggling. They're struggling because the Jews might be seeking advantage from their heritage. The Romans, the Greco-Romans, look down on those of Jewish heritage because they see them as spoiled rats that have received privileges that no one else in the world has received. And they have to work these things out in the church. That's the problem. Things from culture, background, and history spill in. So Paul, I think, is seeking unity. So maybe he can make Rome his next base for the rest of his ministry to go west. At least that's my best guess. One last thing. This is my study of Rodney Stark, 1996. He is a non-believer. He says he wishes he could believe. I don't know why he doesn't. But he studied, and these are conservative numbers of the growth, exponential growth of Christianity. He says there were only about 8,000 in the year 30 AD. That's the day of Pentecost. I disagree with him. I think it's a lot larger than that. I think you can find more than that in Jerusalem, but that's just me. But more importantly is the last number in the year, of the middle of the 4th century, Christianity. Persecuted, surrounded by absolutely staggeringly pagan culture. We think we'd have it hard today preaching the gospel. Try the first century. And yet, look at the numbers. They went from 120 scared people in the upper room, Acts chapter 1, to half of the Roman Empire, 35 million, by the middle of the 4th century. My guess, it can be done once. It can be done again. Thank you.
We'll take about a 10-minute break, and then we'll start with the next session. We do have coffee, decaf, and cafe and coffee right up the double door right here.
Thank you, sir. Very kind of you.
My hotel.